Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. This is Carl from BBN Legion and the ISF podcast. Glad to have you around. We're going to be doing a commentary watch today of a very, very unique film called A Dark Throng. It's a 2016-2017 Irish/Welsh film that came out. And it's a religious horror film, but I don't know if I would even call it that. And I'm going to introduce my guest today, who is very, very much enamored of this film. And so I'd like to introduce John Killian. And John, tell us a little bit about yourself and about how you connected with the film.
Hi, Carl. Thank you so much for having me. Enamored with that film, I think, is a sweet way of putting it, and I appreciate that. I think obsessed would probably be a little bit more accurate. In my other life, I'm a podcaster, and I do a podcast on all sorts of strange and wonderful things called XV Planets, where we dive into mysteries, unknown folklore, things like that. And on occasion, we do these detour episodes where we bounce off of folklore and actual ghost stories, and we start to dive into how magic in the occult has influenced media. And A Dark Song in particular is one of those that hit me like a ton of bricks. It really did. I've never seen anything like it as far as film goes. And as somebody who is pretty involved into occult research and things like that, I don't think I've ever seen a film approach the subject matter with such a respectful and grounded perception of it.
I would agree with that. For those that are listening to these commentary and the podcasts that we do, you all know basically that I have a master's in church music. I have a minor in theology and a minor in philosophy. And so whenever a religious horror movie comes along, as my regular co-host Rachel says, basically the serial killer could be there and to say, "Hey, Carl, we've got a religious horror movie. I'll let you watch it, then I'm going to kill you." I go, "Okay."
Yeah, I mean, seriously.
Go ahead, John. Go.
No, fun thing to pop in. That's something about you that you did not share with me until just today, which I can already tell you this is going to cause a couple of crossover episodes in the near future, because I'm going to have to pick your brain on that, brother.
Well, I'll tell you what. If all goes well, I'd love to be a guest on your podcast and vice versa, and we'll have you back.
Oh,
I think this is going to go. This is going
to
go extremely well. I hope that our listeners will not consider this a college lecture. I'm just saying. What we've got is we've got A Dark Song. I have rented it off of Amazon. If you have a DVD or Blu-ray of it, please prep it right at the beginning. Both John and I are generally at, like, I'm at 3 seconds. I think he's at 2 seconds. And I'm going to slightly adjust my I'm adjusting my volume now. And what we're going to do is I'm going to do a countdown. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, and then go. And on go, you push play. All right. John, are you ready?
I am so ready for this, man.
It's going to be fun. All right. Here we go. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, and go.
And we are going.
And, of course, we've got IFC Midnight. And the interesting thing is this is an Irish film, and it was filmed in Wales. So you'll see a co-production in Wales.
Oh, yeah. And if I may interject for just a second, if you have not done your homework on modern Irish horror films, definitely do a deep dive. There's so much out there.
Oh, absolutely.
Now, this quote, "For he shall give his angels change over thee to keep thee in all thy ways," Psalm 91. Now, you're going to hear a lot of religious references through this, but there is also a lot of dogmatic and occultism based in this. But what's really interesting is if you start talking about occult sciences, if you look at the definition, and I'm sorry, Carl, if you don't mind me riffing for a second while we have this fanning beautiful open scene. So you have the term occult, and occult is by definition referred to, its definition is hidden knowledge. Now, this is not necessarily wrapped up in things of magic or terrible things that people do in the dark with pentagrams and things. It can also refer to the Jewish Kabbalah. It can also refer to multiple types of meditations and concepts focused on Asian countries. So when you hear the word occult, don't cringe at that. Just know that it's tapping into something that is not often talked about.
And the other thing too about this is, though it's based on Christianity, there's much of Kabbalah and Jewish folklore, and also talking about occultism, that also would apply to Gnosticism. And Gnosticism is a very interesting sort of hybrid between the old religions, either Celtic or even Roman or whatever the case would be, Greek, along with Christianity.
No, you're 100%. And before we get past this opening sequence, I just want to point out that the last scene that we saw Catherine paying this landowner a considerable amount of money for this house for an extended period of time. The core of this film is the Abremelin operation, which we're going to go into a little bit deeper as we keep talking about this film. But the important thing to note is that if you do the Abremelin operation, you do have to devote 6 to 18 months of your life in order to do it. Hence her dropping this massive amount of money in order to have this safe space to do it. And at this point, she's now talking with the incredible Steve Odom. I love this guy so much, Carl. Like, he's just amazing.
And basically what you have here is a two-character piece from here on in. There's another actor that comes in a flashback for, like, I think a minute. But basically you're talking about these two characters for the rest of the movie.
And it is so fascinating. Like, all right, so before we go back into, like, the meat and potatoes of this film, something about this film in particular reminded me a lot of The Shining, in the sense that you have a minimal group of actors, and it's up to them in order to make the magic happen, right?
Yeah, I much prefer this film to The Shining, but that's a whole different conversation.
I think they're in two different categories, but I do appreciate that. Yeah, absolutely.
The thing that really got me on this film, and you know, we can talk about the actress here, but the two of them have much different energies. And that melding of those two energies and the friction that it causes is really something. And they both do marvelous work here.
Mm-hmm.
Marvelous work.
Yeah, they're both phenomenal. Now, like, Steve Odom has done several smaller films in Ireland and Wales and in London. But Catherine, I'm sorry, I can't remember her name right now, but the female lead, Catherine, I'm going to have to look this up just to make sure that I don't
hold
muck
on,
it
I got
up.
It. I got it. Give me a second.
Okay.
Okay. So
her root was mostly in Irish stage productions, and I think
Catherine Walker.
Yes. This was her first film lead, and I am absolutely blown away by her performance.
Oh, yeah. And in many ways, without the special effects, this is almost a stage play.
It's not,
there's not a proscenium arch, and it's not, you see a lot of outside shots and so on and so forth. So it's not just relegated to the house, but in many ways it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They keep the set and the setting very small and tight, and that adds to a level of claustrophobia, like coming from a filmmaker standpoint, that adds to a level of claustrophobia and panic, like being trapped in a specific space.
And that really becomes more and more apparent as the movie goes on, and how they feel trapped and just absolutely tethered to this house, mm-hmm, and this particular ritual.
Yeah. Now, just in case you're watching along with us, a few minutes ago there was a scene where they were both in the kitchen, and Steve Odom's character asked Catherine Walker's character, like, so what ritual are you performing? And Catherine Walker hands over a book, looks it open and says, Book of Abremelin. Carl, is this a PG show?
No, go for it.
Okay.
No,
opens up the book
your
and says,
ass off. Go for it.
The Book of Abremelin. You're not fucking around then, eh? And no, you are not. If you're tapping into the Book of Abremelin, this is a pretty deep devotion to a ritual. And it is unlike anything that you will find in right-hand path or left-hand path magic or all these practices. The Book of Abremelin, or the Abremelin Operation, as it's often referred to, is very, very outside of the realm of these types of conceptual magic that you hear about through literature. In fact, it dates back to 1200, I think. Where you
like
had
1260, something like that.
Yeah, so Abraham the Worms, right, made the journey from Germany all the way down the Middle East, ends
Chicago,
up tracking down. What was that?
Cairo, Egypt.
Just outside of it, yes. Yeah, I can't remember the name of the city. I want to say it was Annex, or it was something like that.
Let me take a look. I have it right up here. Hey, I'm actually organized. Praise God. It doesn't really say. It just basically says in the vicinity of Cairo here.
Okay. Well, Abraham of Worms ended up coming across Abremelin the Mage. There you go. Somewhere between 1362 and 1458. And the basically the long run of it was Abremelin the Mage told Abraham of Worms that he would be willing to share his secrets with Abraham of Worms if you are willing to essentially give your gold or give your riches to others. And this is something that you'll find to be consistent in the Abremelin operation, which I find interesting was not really taken into consideration in this particular film. It was kind of loosely at the beginning where Catherine Walker's character was willing to pay way more than was willing for the house and the space. But if you look into the actual Abremelin operation, it is a little bit different than what we see here in this film. The first 3 to 6 months are meant to be spent with 8 to 16 hours of prayer and ritual, and 4 to 6 hours a day, essentially giving up all of your riches to the poor around you. which I always found to be incredibly fascinating, because if you put the Book of Abramelin into modern senses, nobody could afford to do this unless you're a billionaire.
Yeah, and this is true. And, of course, you know, we get into Aleister Crowley later, and he tried to do this twice, I believe, if I'm not mistaken.
True, yeah.
But the thing is, it's not so much that you're rich, but you give what you have, and which I find very interesting because it's a very Christian, Christ-like thing to do. Okay, and the combination of that in terms of something that is, quote, occult and not particularly Christian, to merge those two things, I found fascinating also from a different perspective. It's just that you don't, when you see films like, you know, occult films, religious themed horror films, it's all about the evil. This isn't about evil. Finally,
true,
comes down to, we'll get to at the end, but it's a, I just find the mixing of the two and three things that they do here between, you know, the occult, mysticism, and Christianity is fascinating to me.
No, you're absolutely right about that. But the reason that I made that comment earlier is that if you look into this in a modern time and modern sense, and Carl, have you actually had a chance to read the Book of Abramelin yet?
No, I have not. I have
okay.
not.
So I consider this an open invite. We're going to dive way deeper into this as our relationship continues, my friend. This is actually a deep obsession of mine, because I hope to one day to actually try to perform the Abramelin operation. Now again, it's definitely glossed over and over horrorized in this film. Yet again, it's still the most honest and level portrayal that we've seen of, this operation. Now, the Abramelin operation, yes, is very, very heavily based on Christian standards, like give, do not take. You do your best to give yourself out to the world. The difference is that in modern day senses, the only way that you could perform the Abramelin operation is that if you are a multi-billionaire, have a whole lot of time and a whole lot of money. It's the only way to do it, because it does require a very specific housing structure, which we see just now in the film. Certain windows, certain rooms have to be pointed in certain directions regarding compass. You have to have one base to the north, one base to the south, one to the east, one to the west. Each one of these will essentially be chambers of different magical practices. And they did get that right, using the magic triangle, the mirror, and the meditation with it. But a lot of this is completely unrealistic for modern times, unfortunately. We do not have the stripped-down life that we had before this came back into our culture as of late. And as of late, I don't know about you, I've seen a lot of rise in interest in occult practices. And again, when I say occult practices, hidden knowledge, you know.
Well, for me, you know, you talk about a journey. You know, I am a organist at a Christian Science Church at this point, but I've dealt with many Christian denominations. But when I was younger, it was all about, you know, Castaneda and so on and so forth. I grew up and came of age in the 70s. But another big influence on me as far as, you know, religious thought was Philip K. Dick. And that got me into Gnosticism. And I'm
Oh, you're
very,
tugging
very
on my heartstrings now, buddy. I live for Philip K. Dick, absolutely. All right, so we're going to do a series on Vallis then, apparently.
Well, I'll tell you what, the one I love Vallis and would certainly join you for that. But the one that absolutely fascinates me is Transmigration of Timothy Arch, which is based on Bishop Pope, and Alan Watts is in there too. But I mean, he just opened up my mind and just poured shit in that I'm still trying to process to this day, 40 years later.
I think the same can be said for me trying to plow through the Abramelin operation and all of the absolute bullshit that Aleister Crowley felt as a fetus.
Yeah, exactly. So here is the one scene with her sister.
Yep.
Okay,
This
is the only other scene in the movie where there's another actor. That's it.
I mean, there are extras here and there towards the end, but yes, this is the only other real character that you get. And it's, the first time that I watched this, Carl, before I even knew what was coming, this scene really got to me.
Oh, absolutely.
There was this unspoken thing going on, which was obviously planned. We're not supposed to know the entirety of the situation. But I think one of the greatest things about this film is the mystery behind each and every one of the main characters, and in this case, a secondary character, is there's a lot going on that you never really get full closure on or never really get the whole plate of meat and potatoes, so to speak.
Right. Now, one of the things here in this scene, she says, where is God? Where is his goodness? Something has been taken away from her, and you find out it's her son. Now, you don't know the specifics, but that's not
right.
But that really doesn't matter. You know that there's a loss here she's trying to process. That mm-hmm. deals with grief, and of course you go into the psychological aspect of the segments of grief, what you have to go through. But she's stuck still in anger here. And one of the things we look at, and I looked at it from a more Christian perspective, is that, you know, if you're stuck there's something that you haven't done yet. And I'm not going to say what it is, but it becomes very apparent at the end. I'm not sure if, you know, as I said, I've not read Abramelin, the book of Abramelin. But it seems to me, are they layering too much Christian dogma on this or not? That's a good question for you, since you're a lot more familiar with the ritual of Abramelin, or not.
So I wouldn't say that they're necessarily putting too much on that. Honestly, as somebody who has read the Book of Abramelin twice and still way too dense for me to fully wrap my head around, I'm the first to admit that. But what I have picked up thus far is that in the course of this movie, you will see them, especially as this progresses, once they seal the house, and we'll get to that in a second, you will see them veer further and further away from the Book of Abramelin because they start to go into more dark art stuff. Now, don't get me wrong. If you're talking about the Book of Abramelin, yes, it is it's an incredibly long ritual, and I'll try to condense this before we start to get into the meat and potatoes part of this film, but the Book of Abramelin is a set of instructions on how for you to individually reach your contact point of your personal holy guardian angel. That term is not what you think. Holy guardian angel does not mean I will grant you wishes. It's not a genie. This is actually something very dangerous to pursue. In order to reach the point of communication with your holy guardian angel, you have to go through numerous levels of invoking and then binding specific demons in order to lead you on that path, in order to get you to your holy guardian angel. So you're already playing with fire. And that's where things like the Keys of Solomon come in, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, that still pulls strings from Crowley, and I consider Crowley to be an absolute hack. Okay. The guy was definitely privy to more ancient texts than you and I will ever see in our lives, absolutely. But he was also very singular-minded and had his own motives. So I don't think he was ever pursuing anything for the greater good. He was pursuing things for his own interests. So anything that you read from Crowley, he might be translating from other texts or other subjects, but that does not mean that he was right. And I will give you the Book of Law as a prime example, because the Book of Law was three basic rules. Do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law. Number two is there is no law, love under will. Do what thou wilt should be the whole of the law. Two, love is the law, love under will. Three, there is no law beyond do what thou wilt. Now, if you have a sinister bone in your body, you can manipulate that into whatever the hell you want it to be. And that's right. Where it gets dangerous. Now, me, the first time that I read that, my interpretation of that was, so long as everything that you're doing is out of a place of love, it's going to be good. But he read it as, so I can do whatever I love. Great. Awesome. And that's not how it works. No.
And this is the problem with any religious text, that you can subvert it and you can do what you want with it, or you can cherry pick it. And the meaning is, I won't say it's lost, but it can be perverted.
I'm sorry. I got to chime in for 1 second. If anybody threw a pot of water on me like that, I would have punched him in the face. Just saying.
Yeah.
But please continue.
And by the way,
I'm sorry, Carl.
where they sealed the house too with the salt. So now they're stuck there.
Important to note, like during this process, you are meant to seal off whatever property you're performing the operation on with a very, very, very heavy layer of rock salt. Has to be kosher, but rock salt, and it has to be completely sealed, no breaks in it. And for those of you who are watching along with us or who have never seen this, there is a very particular comment in which, once I seal this line, we unchain ourselves from the world. This is actually true in the Abremelin operation, although that does not come until 6 to 9 months into it.
But already you see control here between the two of them, and he is in control at this point, and he's telling her what to do, and so you start to question his motives on this too.
Right. Yeah.
And what are his motives?
But he actually says it early on is to try to find. I think he put it as to try to find some calm before the howl. That's why he is doing this. And earlier on in the film, he has expressed that he has done this operation 3 times beforehand. 2 times it was unsuccessful. 1 time it was. And so this would make it his 4th iteration on this. I wish I would have gone into a little bit more of the backstory on Steve Odom's character, because it was, I think there's a lot there that I would have liked to have heard. But I also appreciate the incredibly compact nature of this film. It's cutthroat. It's uncompromising. You know. Oh, the toy. This being one of the big. Yep. There's the first little bizarre dream sequence where you get you get little tidbits as to why she's really doing this. And she hasn't really gone into it yet. If you're watching along with us, I wholly appreciate you doing so, but I'm really hoping that you'll take the time to watch this movie in its entirety with all the lights out.
Yeah, that would be a good way to watch this. I happen to agree with that.
Okay, so, Carl, here we go. Now we're getting into... Now we're getting into some actual ritual work here. And they're talking about the different circles that you have to go through. Now, this is interesting for me because these circles that they're talking about are not specifically referenced in the Book of Abramelin. Now you're starting to bring in left-hand and right-hand path magic in different forms. You got a little bit of Kabbalistic stuff going on, and then you also got a whole lot of Hermetic Dawn stuff going on. So the Book of Abramelin is still the core of this, but they are branching out and bringing in other forms of magical practices into it, which, and if you read the Book of Abramelin, makes it unpurified, and you have totally screwed it already.
Right. But then again, this is a movie. Okay? And they're bringing in things for specific reasons in terms of that the audience can connect to it. Because if we take something as dense as the Abramelin contract, most people are either going to fall asleep or like, I don't want to watch this.
It would be too much. Absolutely. Yeah. Now, okay, so this scene, the triangle with the mirror, this is definitely a part of the Abramelin operation, and this is actually a practice that I do myself on a pretty regular basis. I do have a space where I have a triangle built and a mirror based for meditation. As I told you before, I am involved in some occult practices, but it's definitely not what you think, and... what's so strange about it is my dive back into occult practices has actually brought me back to the concept of faith more than I ever could have imagined. It's pretty crazy.
Well, one of the things that I do have to tell you is I have a very close friend of mine who helped me out during a difficult period, and I've known Richard for a number of years. I stayed with Richard for about a year, a couple of years ago, and he is he's the head of a pagan circle. And so I actually got a chance to, you know, a couple of their ceremonies where they let people in, outsiders. And talking to him in that, you know, the thing is you find your faith the way that you practice where, you know, your rituals and things like that. To me, it doesn't matter if you're Jewish, if you're Christian Science,
agreed,
pagan, Muslim, I don't care.
Yeah.
It's what you do with your faith outside toward the people around you and how you treat people and how that translates into your life and how you live your life and how you show your life to other people. Doesn't matter to me what you believe. Don't care.
100%. No, I agree with you. I have many friends of many different faiths, and I think me not having an anchor in one or another has actually allowed me to learn so much more. And here, right now, we're looking at it like he's doing she's doing the Kabbalistic practice of staring into the stone, while Steve Odom's character is using the salt circle to, quote-unquote, unshackle the house from the world. And so now you're going into a deeper sense of branching out way beyond any one particular religion, which for me speaks a lot, because in all of my searching for trying to connect with spirituality, you will come to find that pretty much every major religion has the same absolute basic moral principles. Don't kill, don't cheat, don't lie, don't murder, et cetera, et cetera. And as long as you follow those, you're going to be all right. And that's a universal thing. It really is. But it's when all of these different schools of thought are starting to veer into control by the people around you, that's where it gets tricky. Now, speaking of getting tricky, we're now entering the part of the film where things are starting to get really weird.
And they get weird. We're just letting you know.
Oh, yeah. It's going to get weird. I wouldn't be here if it wasn't, so.
Oh, okay. Well, then you're the perfect guest, because we're always weird on Deviant Legion.
Incredibly strange.
Yeah, that's
films.
Our
come
network,
on, man.
Deviant Legion Network.
I live for this. Come on. Oh, okay. So, all right. One little tidbit. The dog barking that they just mentioned a couple of seconds ago.
Right.
This is something that Gavin Liam himself experienced in the process of writing this film. So anytime he would start to dive way too deep into the film, he had experiences where he would hear random dogs bark whenever he hit an emotional point in the script writing process. And so he decided to write it into the script itself. There's also a considerable amount of creepy stories about this house that they filmed it in. And the fact that it would be a nice, perfect 76 degrees outside in London, but as soon as they stepped inside of the house, the temperature gauges would read at 36 degrees.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, I do have to applaud the writers and director Liam Gavin for this, because they definitely went deeper into this than anybody else did. Oh, and this one, the water torture sequence. So I have actually put myself through this.
Okay, yeah, I ain't going there. I'm just letting you know. No thanks.
I will flat out tell you that I have done quite a few of the lesser rituals that they have done in this film myself, in pursuit of higher knowledge or hidden knowledge, if you will. And they're not for the faint of heart.
And that's one thing this movie does make it very clear, that this is an incredibly difficult ritual.
Mm-hmm.
You're basically self-agonizing yourself. You know, you're putting yourself through these really difficult things to come to a particular place, and we start to figure out what her real motive is. And that's the point. It's the motives. What are the actual
motives? That's the biggest part about this. You never get the full Monty of it until like two-thirds into the film, and we're not going to tell you what it is yet. You're going to have to stick with us. Okay, so this sequence, this kind of messed with me.
Yeah.
Like a lot. Yeah, the moment you start going into, like, blood magic stuff, that's when you're going into official dark magic. Now, officially speaking, if you're looking at the Book of Abrimelin, that's considered to be white magic. It requires no damage, no harm done. In fact, it requires you to put more of yourself out there and to give up all of your worldly possessions. Now, Steve Odom's character offered the shortcut, which was using blood magic, blood sacrifice, in order to let go of one part of the ritual. And all it does is put her right back there again.
Right.
Yeah. So there's a, There's a metaphorical analysis regarding that, is that if you take the easy way out, you will keep having to do it.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, and
I see a lot of...
Well, go ahead, and then I'll hop in. Go ahead, John.
Oh, no, no. After you. I've been rambling. Go on.
The one thing here is that, again, if you do shortcuts, if you don't have a true understanding of whatever rituals, whatever religion you're dealing with and how it relates to you, then, of course, it's going to get screwed up.
Mm-hmm.
And the sense that they're doing it here with the dark magic. But I also take a look at certain denominations of Christians and how, you know, I always say I'm a card carrying liberal Christian, consider myself an Episcopalian, but you take a look at those that vilify certain people and certain segments of our society and who choose to judge. Those are the things that to me truly pollute true spirituality. I really believe that with all my
heart. Oh, yeah, no, absolutely. I agree with you. There is a pure spiritual core to the vast majority of these things, but it's humanity that ends up wrecking it because we're all imperfect and we all want to manipulate it or redefine it to fit our own means. And this is where conflict comes from regarding that. Whereas me, like I was an atheist or agnostic for so long, but it's so funny that it took me doing deep dives back into the occult to make me realize that, yes, there absolutely is something out there beyond us. I just think that nobody's really gotten it right as far as the interpretation goes.
Nobody will ever get it right. I always say that you know, however we practice, the only way we know that, you know, when you know, worshiping God or worshiping the higher deity, however you want to say it, the only way we're going to worship perfectly is when we die and we go over there, because we fuck it up here all the fucking time. Seriously.
We have no idea what's over there.
We have no idea. I have no idea if I'm right. Doesn't matter. I don't care to be right. I just care to believe the way I do and to reflect it toward the other people around me and do it in a good, humane way. That's it.
I think that's a good way of putting it. Like, I am not the person to come and talk to you about what it is or what's beyond, but if you want to have a good conversation about how we should be decent human beings and how to better ourselves in preparation for whatever comes next, yeah, that's something we can all equally talk about, you know?
Absolutely.
Oh, absolutely. God, this is one of the creepiest scenes. The knock.
I come in.
It kills me every time.
Knocking at the door?
What was that?
Who's knocking at the door? I want to come in.
Right.
Creepy as fuck.
I got to be honest with you. What really shook me about this particular scene is that I've had a very similar experience.
You know, we all have experiences. Now, my otherworldly experience is that over a number of years, when somebody close has passed away to me, my mother, my father, so on and so forth, I either knew exactly when they passed away or in terms of my father, I found out I called. Something told me to call, and I called and I talked to my father. And I found out later, 15 minutes after he hung up the phone, he died. And that's
You're in
been
good company, my friend.
Yeah, I mean, there are things we do not understand. And I have a very good friend of mine, Bill Reynolds, who's been on the podcast, and he's a film fanatic and so on and so forth. But he is hardcore, and so I attack him from a philosophical sense that if we take a look at something like epistemology and we take a look at what's real, that but if I say something like, you know, where does our essence, our soul go after we die? They are two completely different things, and you can't use either, you know, you can't use epistemology to prove or disprove of, you know, God. You can't do it. You know, you can't do that. And so we have this argument all the time, and it's a very, very, you know, we have a lot of fun with it. But he's, I'm still trying to convince him that being an atheist is still a belief system. He won't go with me on that, but damn it, it is. Never mind. Okay, I'm not.
No. Actually, no. I totally understand what you're getting. However, this is an important moment with her losing, and that is really pretty triangle. Buddy, you and I need to have some conversations off of this show for certain.
We're going to definitely personal phone calls and PM each other our phones. Oh, there's no doubt you and I are talking. No doubt.
Oh yeah. No, it's on now. I never really I guess for the longest time I considered myself to be an atheist, but at this point I would consider myself to be agnostic, meaning that I am totally open and willing to the belief of something out there greater than you and me and all of us. However, I don't think any of
you
us
have no further clue what
it
is.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. That being said, and I'm going to leave you with this mystery, I've had two near-death experiences, and one of them, buddy, I got things to talk to you about. But
yep.
Back to
yep.
This is the uncomfortable part of the movie.
Well, right now we're in the uncomfortable part, and it's uncomfortable until it ends. So, yeah.
Yeah. No, I can handle everything else in the film except for this one part, like the whole abuse of power and control from Steve Odom. And honestly, it's done in a comical way in this film, so it's not like it's still invasive and it's still uncomfortable, but it's also, you know, like, you're an asshole.
This is where
dude.
He really,
like, it's pretty much what
really
down.
Very fucked up. This is where he fucks up.
Yeah, no, it's very true. Now, Carl, I'm very, very sorry to say this, but can you excuse me for 90 seconds? Because I got a dog that is just scratching at the door and will not stop. So I will be right back.
By all means, I'll take it from here. Go for it.
Yeah. Let this keep playing. I'll be right back in a second, brother.
Okay. Carl, so what we got here, folks, is a very uncomfortable scene. And what I was talking about, where people will take advantage, and that's exactly what happens here. Therefore, the purity of the ritual is no longer pure. So they are both basically, you know, they're screwed. And this is just... And of course, he's masturbating now. Yeah, this is not a good thing. And it's very uncomfortable. And it's, you know, I mean, you could go and talk about the whole thing about the Irish Catholic Church and how the number of different things, you know, with the abuse, and then of course the killing of the babies and so on and so forth, and nunneries. I mean, all of this is so much mirrored here in this particular scene. And for someone like me and John, it's just, not good. It's not good. Okay, so we just went through that, and I said, basically that for me, this mirrors a lot of the abuse of the Catholic Church in Ireland and the sexual abuse and that sort of thing. And of course, here she's pouring in urine into the
soup. Look, I'm sorry. I was raised Catholic, and I don't want to go into that, but this particular scene makes me really happy. So let her enjoy her revenge. I do get a kick out of that, though, how subtle and how sly she was about this. Carl, every time I go back and watch this movie, I am still just so utterly blown away by both of them. Catherine Walker, Steve Odom, they did such an amazing job in this film.
You know, one of the things we have not really talked about is the cinematography, the staging, and the set design.
God.
That there's so much in this.
But also so minimalist. Like, if you look... Oh, God, this scene. I'm sorry. Look, let's give this a second.
No.
So this is the point where he's trying to convince her that if you walk out of here, if you walk across that salt mine, you're going to break it, and they're going to be stuck in this limbo forever. And this is an important thing to remember. Anybody who's actually listening to this comes into play later. And it's a pretty important part of the story. I gotta tell you, like, the first time I saw this movie, I did such a deep dive on both of them. What else have they done? It was so beautifully refined, and it was masterfully filmed. Like, the cinematography to it is absolutely breathtaking.
Well, take a look at that scene right there with the yellow behind it, and she's drinking the blood, and the color, segments, the candle there, everything mm-hmm. is just so clear, and yet so muted. It's a beautiful, beautiful.
Now I got to look it up and see who the actual cinematographer was, because the balance that they had between these beautifully framed photos and then toying with the color palette in order to invoke certain emotions was absolutely phenomenal.
Agreed. I'm looking it up now, so give me a second.
Music was composed by a guy named Ray Harmon. Cinematographer was Cathal Walters, who I've never heard of before, but I'm looking into right now. There we go. Cinematographer. Oh, he's the cinematographer for two of the upcoming Foundation episodes for Apple TV Plus, which I'm super stoked about because I'm a diehard Asimov fan. Peaky Blinders.
Good for you.
Dark Song. He's done a lot of television work, but not a considerable amount of films. I'm going to have to do a little bit of a deeper dive into his work. Good for Me, are you not an Asimov fan?
Oh, no. I certainly like Asimov. No question about that. When I was young, all I did was read. I actually, one thing I don't think I told you is I was actually born with cerebral palsy. I was in braces until I was 8. And now you could hardly tell. I mean, you talk about, the healing power or whatever, I'm part of that. That's for sure. But
I had no idea. I'm glad you healed, my friend.
I read Bradbury, S is for Space, R is for Rocket, Asimov. And then what really changed me was reading Dangerous Visions. The Harlan Ellison anthology. And of course that introduced me to Philip Jose Farmer and Philip K. Dick and all these new wave science fiction people, and then I I was hooked forever and ever.
Right. Yeah. Oh, yeah, man. You and I are going to have a lot of conversations after this. And don't forget, this is the first time you and I have spoken.
Absolutely. Yes, yes, I can guarantee you that John will be on again. I'm just letting you know now. And most of you will run away screaming because we'll be talking about religion and mysticism. But you know what? Deal with it.
Oh, no, it doesn't have to be that. You can bring me into any of this. Like, no, like, come on. I've been on the ISF page for a couple of years now, and I love all the conversations that happen there. You can pull me into anything. You want to talk about science fiction? We can do a deep dive on Philip K. Dick in film or even just do a dive into the literature. Like, I'm into all of it. I am not boxed into one genre. I am captivated by good work, and A Dark Song is really good work.
Well, the one thing that really fascinated me about this film is how it just feels real.
Yep.
This feels so real.
It's one of the most grounded horror films I've ever seen in my life. Yeah. And as somebody who messes around with a lot of the stuff, and like, Carl, I know you don't know too much about me personally, but me and my podcast, like, we go out and we do paranormal investigations. We've had a lot of really, really uncomfortable and strange, but also wondrous experiences. And a lot of them can be compared to, like, the first two-thirds of this movie. No, we haven't been attacked by by a horde of weirdos in the basement or seen my holy guardian angel, but we've seen and experienced things that are unexplainable. So this is why this movie touches me so much, is that it's one of the first that I think approached it in a sense that actually makes sense to me, if that makes any sense at all.
Okay, now we have to go back to this because we're just told why she wants to do this. It's for vengeance.
Yep.
Because someone did a ritual on her 7-year-old and killed him.
Yeah, please continue. Fill in the crowd because you and I rambled for a bit. Run with it. Go.
Okay, so we just found that out. So what she told him at the beginning, she lied. And the thing is, if you go into any ritual and you're not being true to yourself, you're destroying the ritual.
If your intent is not pure.
In the Catholic Church, you can't go to communion if you don't. I'm not going to say the word yet because I'm going to wait until it really comes through here at the end. But
you're good. I like that.
Well, one of my favorite films, and I do have to ask you about this. Have you ever seen Calvary with Brendan Gleeson?
It's sitting on my shelf right now. Yes.
Okay. But what he says to his daughter in there is that, I shall just say, the F word is underrated as a blessing. And it's true. It's very, very true. But if you don't come with a clean heart into communion, it doesn't work. Okay.
Yep.
And so both of these people have come into this specific ritual not clean. And this is the most disturbing fucking scene in the movie for me.
Fair enough. We're gonna take a moment of silence on this one.
Yeah, we are. We have been rambling way too much.
Not enough, in my opinion, but for this moment.
Not really. but this one we have to be quiet.
But are you kidding me? We can hit this movie on repeat and keep going after this if you want. Like, I'm game. But, yeah, this is...
But we could always do a second one.
I think it would be great. Honestly, I've been trying to reach out to Liam Gavin. If I can hook him, I would love to to do a three-part commentary on this, to be honest.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, man. So the second that he starts naming off all of the different names, Ball. As soon as I saw Ball, I was like, I know exactly where this is going, and this is not going to be good. Oh, shit. Carl, I'm going to go grab a bottle of wine. I'll be right back.
Okay, go for it. Understood.
So as I said, as somebody who has experienced two near-death experiences, one of which I actually was officially dead for several minutes, yeah, this one's tough.
This one's extremely tough.
Mm-hmm. But so scaling it back from the spiritual and emotional content of this film, I also want to take this moment to point out the genius of the cinematography and of every shot of this movie, really. Like, I know that they were running on a micro budget, but every frame, every focus, everything is done with such brilliant taste. It really is.
Mm-hmm.
None of this was made to glorify any of it. In fact, it was made to show the deep sadness behind it, you know? Ugh.
When he says, let her touch the void, I knew exactly what was going to happen. I know.
I'm going to formally request that the next time we do this, we do a comedy horror just to balance this out, really.
Yeah, seriously.
But again, like, this is what makes this film so powerful. It doesn't pull punches. It doesn't rely on cheap gimmicks. It does not rely on shock value, although you do have a couple of those moments in here, but they're still tastefully done and tastefully placed. And they're actually handling the subject matter with a fair amount of respect, at least amount of respect that we've never seen in the cinematic world, you know?
Right. I mean, you take a look at any religious horror film, and they tend to be grandiose. Or you take a look at any haunted house film. They tend to be grandiose and the big scares and that. That's not what this is about.
That's not the reality of it. As a paranormal investigator, I'll flat out tell you, 90% of the time, you're not going to get a damn thing. And the 10% that you do get will be very personal to you, but you'll have no proof of it for anyone else.
No. All these things can't be proven. As I said before, when I was talking about Bill Reynolds, you can't prove this.
Yeah.
It's not of the, you know, the one thing about the Christian Science scientists, which I'm now an ordinance, is they believe very, very much in a spiritual realm that has to come down and envelop you.
Ow.
Oh, yeah.
It's, yeah, ow. Oh. It's like one of the only moments of gore in this film, but is also one of the most effective.
Right. In fact, I think it's the only gore in this film. I think it's the only time.
I don't think so, but I think this is the biggest one, definitely. But it was, yeah, that was, this is it. No. Okay, so this scene, in my opinion, this is a tide turner for the emotional tone of the film. From this point forward, you see these two characters interacting very, very differently and a little bit more intimately and more concerned for each other and also concerned with themselves, which neither of them have had throughout the course of all
right.
of this. So, I never made that connection until this particular conversation. This is the moment where the focus for both of the main characters turns towards their actual humanity as opposed to pursuing the unknown. I think that's pretty powerful, actually. I cannot wait to see what this guy does next, Carl. Seriously.
Wow. Listen, Liam Gavin is someone we are looking to see what he does next, because this was his debut film. Consider that.
I know.
This is the first
I know. Oh, God, believe me.
And, like, he knocks it out of the fucking park. There's only a couple people I would put above him as far as debuts. And one of them would be Charles Lawton, and the other one would be Saul Bass.
All right, so Carl, if you have the time, I'm going to formally ask that once this film is over, you and I have a 15 to 20 minute discussion regarding those subjects, other people who have touched onto this in such fashion and things like that. I'm sure the crowd listening would get a kick out of it, but are you up for hanging around for 15, 20 minutes after the film is over?
Well, we basically have a 2-hour limit here with Blog Talk. We'll see what happens. Now, generally, they'll let us go over, but sometimes they'd like to cut us off right at the 2 hours. You never know with a British lady woman, you know.
Okay, well, if the British lady cuts our losses, then I encourage you to call me afterwards and let's talk about
Absolutely.
This. Because honestly, I've got my own thing going on. I would really love to get you involved on it, but we'll talk about that later. We are now okay. So here it is.
Now it's really fucking creepy.
Yes, now that Steve has been damaged and a blood sacrifice, quote-unquote, has been made, we're going to start seeing some anomalies happening. Now, before it gets too crazy, I need to point out that this is where it deviates very, very, very freaking far from the Abremelin operation. Because the Abremelin operation, there is no blood sacrifices involved. There is no damage to other humans. There is a considerable amount of giving up what you have and a whole lot of prayer, focus, and meditation. And, okay, actually, I got to take that back. In the ancient text, I do believe there were a couple of animal sacrifices. But from what I've understood, you can replace that with your own blood sacrifices. So, you know, if you cut yourself and give a little bit of your blood into the process, then you can achieve the same thing. Don't quote me on that. I'm still learning myself. But this stuff really does fascinate me. In particular, the Abremelin operation captivates me because it's not black magic. It's not left-hand path. It's not right-hand path. It is a very, very specific form of long-form meditation where you have to give up a lot in order to connect with something higher than you. And this mm-hmm. still fascinates me to this day. And I'll tell you right now, if I was ever lucky enough to win the lottery, I'd probably give the vast majority of it away. But the rest, I'd go buy a villa in Italy and I would go to the Abremelin operation.
Well, one of the things here I did want to talk about the film itself is that now the sound design person comes to fore. Okay? And
oh,
and,
God, it
and,
gets
and,
so good from here.
I mean, seriously. And remember, they're doing this on an extremely small budget. I think it was like $1.2 million. It wasn't that much at all that they raised.
Yeah, I think 1.5 might have been the cap off. It was really, really low. But look at what they did with that. Like, you don't need these flashy things in order to create. We need atmosphere back in film. Nobody's paying attention. Oh, God. Ow.
Yeah.
Sorry, we're witnessing the bandage peel at the moment. And for those of you listening, I kind of hope you're not watching because that just made me cringe a little. But no, there's a lot of beauty out there that gets lost. Yeah, film industry is just like the music industry. It's all about who you know and who you can connect with, and unfortunately, the vast majority of us are really happy with 2 to 3 minute packaged doses of media. Whereas I love
things. And
like
I think we've lost our sense of patience and letting something wash over you, which this movie certainly does. Okay. And my favorite
I'm sorry, go ahead. Your favorite horror film? Go ahead.
My favorite type of horror film are those with atmosphere. You know, things like The Changeling, which is my all-time favorite ghost story. This film.
So good.
Oh, yeah.
So what was it? So, what was the last one you said?
Well, this one now I can't remember. This is what happens when you're 63 years old and, like, starting to use your walker. Never mind.
You were not 63 years old.
Yeah, I'm 63 years old.
Seriously?
Seriously. Born in 1958.
Wouldn't have pegged you for it. I'm sorry. I saw the incredibly handsome picture of you with your cat, which was highly illustrated. I would
way,
have pegged you for mid-40s,
you know,
but, you know, whatever.
You know that's Philip K. Dick? That's Philip K. Dick.
That's not you?
That's not me. My ex-wife says I look like Philip K. Dick.
All right, buddy. Yeah, you and I are going to have to connect. Okay, so beyond this and beyond The Changeling, what else? Oh, wait.
No, we can't think anymore.
Yeah, no. We're at the final stretch. Oh. This part really messed with me. The whole help me, mommy thing.
That's not you.
Carl, I have a feeling that you and I need to develop a Mystery Science Theater 3000 type of thing for horror films. I'm going to work on this, and I'm going to throw a couple of curveballs at you here in the next couple of weeks.
Absolutely.
Like, this is upsetting to me because I know that we're coming towards the end and I don't want it to end. So this is something that we're going to have to talk about, buddy.
Oh, not a problem, John. I'm in. I'm definitely in.
Okay, well, when this is over, I'm going to give you a quick call if you're up for it. Or you're going to have to call me because you got my number. But I got something to run by you. But, oh, buddy, this is the moment. I am flat out stating that Catherine Walker is one of the most underrated worldwide actresses in the world right now. Seriously, like this movie blew me away, and the only reason that it did was because of her and Steve Odom. Had you put anybody else in these roles, I would not have given a flying fuck, to be honest. They nailed it. It was brilliant. It was tasteful, and it is horrifying. Not just fucking scary, but really honest to God horrifying. Like it digs into the soul as opposed to shock value, which I don't care about shock value. Show me. Oh.
God.
Yeah, this.
And you're right about the two characters now caring more about each other. You can see he's not well. He's infected. That's not a good thing.
He knows that she's the only comfort that he can have. She knows that he is the only person that she can find comfort in at this particular moment. And seriously, I really want to talk to Liam Gavin. And I am, Carl, I'm on a mission at this point. I am going to find a way to bring him into the conversation, and you better believe I'll bring you into it as well.
Oh, absolutely. I remember first seeing this film, and I saw it on I think it was Netflix or somewhere. I did not see it.
It was Netflix to me.
And I'm just saying, oh my God, where did this come from? And who is this person that wrote it? And can I meet him?
Right?
And can we like talk for 48 hours straight? Seriously.
Okay, so I am a horror nut, as you obviously already know. And since the day I've gotten comfortable with that, I have always been in constant search for the films that affect me the same way that The Shining did when I first saw it when I was 15 years old. Now, granted, you grow older, you get thicker skin, you have to develop resilience to things. But I'm still, there's something about that artificial fear that I deeply love and adore. And I honestly can say that the only ones that have tapped into it for me have been A Dark Song and Lars von Trier's Antichrist.
Yeah, which I can't get through. Sorry. I think it's way too
mean. I don't blame you for that. I don't blame you for that for not even a second. We're going to be doing a deep dive on that on our offshoot series here in the near future. And feel free to listen in, but I won't ask you to join that conversation. Antichrist and this, only things that have been able to tap into true primal fear for me. And this fucking film is... God, the fucking cigarette scene. Oh, God.
Yeah.
It's still like every hair on my body is standing up right now as I'm watching this. Seriously.
Yeah. This is a rough film. I mean, you know, and the thing is you have to be invested in it. And I think that's one of the big problems with a lot of our people. Younger people, our main demographic at ISF is like 24 to 35. Oh, and
Carl,
yes,
you and I definitely have to carry on this conversation, but a moment of silence.
Yes, and we'll be quiet now.
That is such an emotionally intense moment in this film.
And now she's alone.
That was hard. But honestly, like, Steve Odom's unabashed tenderism regarding it and what Catherine becomes after this scene is kind of a game changer for the whole thing. But
Become different because once he gets the knife in his abdomen, you see her in the background doing more and more studying and that. And of course, here she is at the books now and they've changed. Some of it is blank. And,
she has become him.
Yeah.
Yeah, actually. Oh, wow. Okay. Which doesn't make that death any easier, but actually, that's a good point. I didn't really take that into consideration that the moment that happened, like her whole dynamic shifted. I think that has a lot to do with the fact that I've always considered Catherine Walker's character to be a very, very strong, powerful presence and female presence in the entire film. But you're right, after this switch, it becomes something completely different.
Well, this is the whole point of any spiritual journey. You get to a point which I like to call the sonic sledgehammer, which is when, you know, God or whatever you want to call, you know, the mysticism hits you over the head like,
yeah,
asshole, you got to change now. You got to do it.
Well, buddy, you and I definitely have to talk after this. Oh. Carl, I know we're reaching the end, and at this point, I'm going to start scaling back my commentary because we're about to slowly inch into the climax. But I want you to know how much I deeply appreciate you inviting me on here into Incredibly Strange Films. And what is the other name of the podcast that you refer to it as?
Deviant Legion Network is our network.
Okay. So I will connect with you after the show is over in order to spread that a little bit more properly. But
well, also, I will want to give you some time at the end of this to promote your podcast, because you need to do that.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you. I appreciate that. Oh, wait. Oh, she did it. She did the thing.
Yeah.
She did it. She walked past the salt.
Yep, she did. I think I'm a little above past you, so I'm going to just hold this for a second. I'm at like 120.29, so I'm about 30 seconds or 45 seconds.
Okay, Carl, this is one of the most beautiful scenes I've ever seen. Look at this.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
I mean, that's, you know, the whole thing around whales and the beautiful nature and everything, it's just gorgeous.
Never had the chance to see it.
No.
Hopefully that'll happen next year, but we'll see. But the cinematography, especially these long landscaping pieces that they do like this, and I don't know, you're looking at the zigzag thing that I'm looking at right now. Like, yeah, Liam Gavin, great director. I want to know who in the fuck this cinematographer is, and I want to follow everything that he does, so long as he does it like that, because that is it's beautiful. It's amazing. Like, the whole film, this whole movie is absolutely beautiful front to back, even including the most horrific scenes in it. It is
Absolutely.
Beautifully presented. It is perfectly framed. Every cinematographer knows exactly what they're doing. This is, it's just so good.
And then she comes back into the house and all hell's going to break loose. She's letting you know.
So I guess now is the point that you and I should be quiet. Yeah. Yeah,
but we're all,
there it is.
I do want to say something, is that we're coming up
please.
To what she needs to do to break through. She's been wanting vengeance all the way through. But now she
thank
has
you
to
for
do
bringing
something.
That. Yeah, thank you for bringing that back up. 100% yes. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, no, but we should be quiet anyway.
Last thing I'm going to say for the next 10 minutes is I hope that all of you that are out there, that are geeking out with us, are watching this. And if you've only been listening to us, shut us off and listen to the original audio. And I'm going to be quiet now.
Again, sound design. Score.
Carl, that cinematography on that bathroom scene just a few seconds ago.
Oh, God. It's amazing.
Mind blowing.
Oh, shit.
Here we go.
Oh, man.
Oh, that just gave me tingles.
Carl, this whole fucking movie gives me tingles. It's true, like that. This
oh.
Every, yep, nope, going to be quiet. Done.
Can't get away from your transgressions, dear. Doesn't work that way.
Carl, I got many things to say, but I'm not going to ruin this. Let's roll with it.
Now she's apologizing to him. I'm so sorry.
Yeah, this scene is so hard.
But she has to apologize to somebody else before she can get atonement. That's what she has to learn.
Yeah, in order to reach atonement, you have to transgress your sins. This is actually
exactly.
A big part of the Abramelin operation. So, it's interesting the way that they showed it in this film, but that's not the way that the actual operation goes. So at this point, I have no official information to offer. This is all up to speculation, but it's still really fucking good.
So it's very interesting that they talked about limbo. Now, when you talk about limbo,
about what?
Or purgatory, that's where
purgatory?
She is right now. Yeah, purgatory, limbo.
Yes.
Because he mentions limbo. If you go across the line, we'll be stuck in limbo.
Yes. No, you're absolutely right. But purgatory and limbo are actually the same thing if you look into
yeah.
the overall connection to it all. But and that's where she is. Ever since that salt line was covered, they are now stuck. They are stuck in limbo or purgatory or whatever you want to call it. Which is a concept that has always fascinated me, and I don't think I've ever seen a film ever tackle it the way that this one did.
No. Fuck.
It's a very pretty toy. Now, Carl, I know that you understand as much as I do. That low-key, no stimulation horror, and now I'm going to be quiet. Because of that. Okay, so Carl, now I got 2 seconds to ask you. Have you ever seen a movie called Baskin?
Yes. Very interesting.
I am seeing a whole lot of similarities right now.
Yeah.
On this point.
Now, what do these souls represent? To me, they're the doomed souls who have not been able to get out of limbo. Or are they demons? That's a good question.
Okay. Great question. Okay, so all of these random spirits that you're seeing, all of these pasty white hands are reaching out. The reference there is a considerable amount of Christian or pre-Christian demons or daemons or deities of all sides of the spectrum of light who never really had a foothold on moving forward. Okay?
Okay, right there.
And so...
He says, I am so sorry for what I've done. Suddenly the light comes.
So going through the Abremelin operation, in order to reach the council of your higher guardian angel, you do have to go through several routines of invoking and then binding demons. And this is something that nobody ever talks about, the Abremelin operation is... You have to stir up the devil in a broad quotation sense. But you have to stir that up and know how to bind it and keep it at bay. Here we go. grand finale. But yeah, you have to go through numerous steps of invoking a considerable amount of demons and then binding them and bending them to your will before you are allowed to reach this ascension that our main character is having right now. And this kills me.
And that slight smile. The guardian angel.
But her response being, I am sorry.
I want the power to forgive.
Carl, I'm sorry, I'm going to tear up a little bit here. Because this one hits me pretty hard.
But you know, I mean, I kept saying the F word.
Wait.
This is all about forgiveness. You have to forgive yourself for what you've done. And you have to forgive others. And she's finally learned what it is to break free of all that guilt and all that anger that she's had, and this wonderful smile at the guardian angel.
Okay, so this is where it gets really interesting for me, is that she had to ask for the power to forgive. She had to ask for that. And that's almost like a letting go in a religious state. Like, I let go my personal connections and things like that, and I give you, Lord, whatever you worship, to take control. I want the power to forgive. I gotta admit, Carl, that comment shook me to my core. Still makes me cry every time I watch this movie. When I see that final sequence, I want the power to forgive. Still makes me cry. Even
Absolutely.
Years after seeing that film. Yeah.
And look at her face right now. She's driving. You know, it's like, what did I just go through? Is it real? Am I, you know, where am I? It's this life-changing thing that goes right through her face, and that's all acting, and it's amazing.
I think the real root is, you know, I ask for the ability to forgive myself.
Right.
I really think that was the whole root of that story.
Yeah. Well, forgiveness is a big thing for me. And realizing what you've done wrong. And admitting it not just to yourself, but to the people you wronged. You know, I mean,
right.
That is, you know, I mean, you can say that's a Christian thing, but that actually goes through most religions, if not all. But what a tremendous film. Oh, my God.
Brother, I think that's an understatement, to be honest. And I think this is the first of a long stream of amazing conversations that we can have. Like I said, I have no time. If you want to restart this and go back over it, I'm all game. But
maybe
we can spread it out to the masses.
Not tonight. Not tonight.
All right.
That's enough for me. I'm spent.
I'm all wound up. You fucking got me all wound up.
Oh, man, that was good. So, final thoughts on the film.
Final thoughts on Dark Song?
Yeah.
I have none. This is a movie that is worth watching several times over, and what I'm hoping is that you and I will revisit this at least every 6 months to a year and maybe spread it out to a larger audience and get some other people involved. It's an amazing film. It handled spirituality and also off-the-cuff spirituality in a really respectful and beautiful way. And I think there is a way to bring multiple people into this conversation. And I think this was a great start to something that could be even greater, Carl, really. Thank you so much for having me. This has been absolutely amazing. I cannot thank you enough for this. Obviously, this is one of my favorite films of all time. Always happy to talk about it. Seriously, thank you so much for having me. This has been a blast.
Well, absolutely. Now, let me just let you know that I have just PM'd you my phone number, my cell phone number, so we can have a conversation after this. But first, before we do anything, please promote your podcast and tell our listeners all about your podcast and what you do and where we can find you and what it's named and all that sort of good stuff.
Oh, yeah, sure. Hey, thank you so much. I appreciate that. Our main podcast right now is called XV Planets. That's EX space V space PLANIS. You can find us anywhere that you get your podcasts. We do deep dives into local folklore, high strangeness. Me and my co-hosts are both deeply involved in a whole lot of things that I can't really talk about right now, but there's a lot of things on the horizon, and if you're into things of strange natures or things that make you raise an eyebrow, well, come and give a listen. We're more than happy to have you. Carl, you can better believe I'm going to be dragging your ass up there with us here.
Be sure to give me a link for sure, so I can get there.
No, but
I do want to go into a little bit of housekeeping right now before we continue our conversation.
I'm going to go ahead and step off stage and say goodnight to everybody, and I'll catch up with you after the show is over. Does that sound good?
Oh, I want you to stick around. It's not going to take that long.
Well,
and we can talk
no
a little bit
I'm
more
here.
Before we get off. On Monday, we had Joe Lansdale on, and we were very happy to do that. And Joe, if you don't know, is an author. He wrote the Happen Leonard series and of course, Bubba Hotep and Incident on and Off of the Mountain Road. His book, short stories and books have been adapted all throughout TV and film.
I'm sorry. Did you say Bubba Hotep?
Yeah.
Did you say Don Carsoli?
No, I didn't say Don Coscarelli. I said Joe Lansdale.
Okay.
Joe is the author of the screenplay.
Holy crap. All right, brother, you keep me on speed dial. That's all I'm going to say.
Okay, well, I have some more to tell you. So that was Monday. Yesterday, we had voice actor Doug Stone on, and Doug has done several
animes, and he's been doing voice work since the early 80s, but he is now featured in the Netflix anime series of Resident Evil. And he's one of the cast members there.
Wow. Awesome.
So,
that is fantastic.
So we had him. And today, of course, we had you. And that's wonderful. And we did a dark song. Now, tomorrow, author and reviewer Patrick Crane will be on us with us. And we're going to be doing... a deep dive into the films of Robert Altman, who is my favorite director, and also my all-time favorite film is Born to Die. Okay, so we're going to be doing that on Thursday.
You're definitely
Then
my
on
people.
Saturday, we're going to be doing a commentary watch. We're going to go back to my hidden gems of the 70s. Now I didn't tell you this. So when I was 14 years old, my folks bought a music store in Bradford, Pennsylvania. This was 1972. And one of our customers ran the local drive-in, which was Limestone Drive-In. So I started, quote, working at a drive-in like when I was 15. And we also had early home box office. So the whole 70s was my era of films. And so there's a lot of films in the 70s people don't know. And I've been doing a series of like hidden gems. And we're going to be doing on Saturday a commentary watch, pardon me, on The Nickel Ride, which is a 70s noir starring Jason Miller, Linda Haynes, John Hillerman, and Bo Hopkins. It's a wonderful film if you've never seen it. So we'll be doing that. We have upcoming shows both on, though not set in stone yet, as far as when we're doing them, the week after. We're going to be doing two shows in memoriam of Robert Downey Sr., and also William Smith, who passed away. So we'll be doing those. And then upcoming in early August and late July, we have Stephen Eckleberry is going to come in with us. Now, you may not know the name, but you certainly know his wife who passed away, and that would be Karen Black. And so we're going to be talking about her. Not only her filmography, but when she was doing Nashville with Altman, she also recorded a number of songs that were never released. And there is a new album coming out of her songs, her original songs. That's supposed to be due out in August. So we'll be doing that. And also we'll be having in early August, Trent Harris, who directed Ribbon and Ed, is going to be coming back with us. So,
man.
And
Carl,
got a new
where
movie
have
out.
You been all my, where have you been all my life? Sorry,
so, yeah,
on that note, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, please. This has been so good. Thank you so much for having me, man.
Oh, absolutely. And as I said, I just gave you my home phone number. Give me about 10 minutes and give me a call.
You got
All
it,
right?
All right.
Well, folks, we're going to call this a night. I'm glad you enjoyed the film. And do watch it without our commentary again, please, because you deserve to see something that good again. All right?
And seriously, the filmmakers and creators of A Dark Song deserve your attention. They really do. Like, me as a diehard horror aficionado, self-proclaimed, I'll admit that, it is one of the most respectful and also tasteful horror films I've ever seen in my life. So give it a shot. If you can't really get into it in 45 minutes, then you're probably on a brainwave pattern that I don't need to talk to anyway. So, you know, whatever. No, I'm not even
all right,
on that. Seriously.
We're
going to
call this a night. Enjoy. And hopefully we'll see you tomorrow for our nice deep dive into Robert Altman films with Patrick Crane. All right, folks. Good night, everyone. Talk to you in a little bit, John.
Hope I can be there. Y'all have a good night.
All right. Good night.